Nikki did ASL. I am very.
I call the board study session and board meeting to order at 5:30 p.m. That's May 31st of 2017. Dr. Mitchell, can we have roll call?
Yes. Angelina Pride is absent at this time. She is hoping to join us as soon as possible. She's tied up with a work obligation. David Malkin?
Present.
Donna Friedman?
Here.
Carrie Chen?
Here.
Lynn Ebenkamp?
Here.
Thank you.
May I have a motion to adopt the agenda of the board study session of Wednesday, May 31st, 2017?
I motion to adopt the agenda.
Second. Any discussion? Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Would you please all stand for the flag salute? Month in May, remembering Memorial Day, so please say the Pledge of Allegiance with me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have a series of reports tonight. And we're going to start out with the energy, the way it's on the agenda, right?
Facility. Just do facilities and then I'll take it. It's just facilities presentation.
Okay, so I got the wrong thing. Let me use yours.
Can you work?
The first report will be facilities presentation on the 2012 bond projects. Alex?
Good evening, Board President Ebenkamp. Board members, Superintendent Dr. Mitchell, cabinet, and guests. We're really excited tonight to have a presentation on some Measure R 2012 projects. And it's going to be nice because it's going to be three different presentations regarding different phases of our projects. One project in the early phase of planning, the Oswald New Campus project. One in the final planning phase, the Nogales Building H Music Building. And Building F, small theater and classrooms, and another in the construction phase, the Roland High School addition project. For each of these projects, key team members will lead each of the presentations. Staff from Zimba and Prieto Architects will speak about the Nogales and Oswald projects, and staff from the construction management firm of Ledesma Meyer will speak about the Roland High School project. I'd like to call to the microphone, Jorge.
Do we want to dim the light? I think you turned the.
Good evening, Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Mitchell, and everyone in attendance. My name is Jorge Prieto. I am the president of Ziemba and Prieto Architects, and I'm here to talk about the Oswald Academy, the design process. Mr. Price here will be talking about the Nogales projects after me. The design process is composed of four major phases. The four phases are programming, schematic design, design development, and construction documents. The first phase, the programming phase, is where we establish the program for the project. It involves doing some existing site analysis, verifying as-built information, obtaining topographic surveys, and then also obtaining and preparing a educational specifications. We have a consultant, Betty Hansen. She'll be talking about the educational specifications after our presentation. The next phase, once we've established a program that established with the stakeholders district site staff, and with assistance of the outreach program that we're doing with the community, we move on to the next phase, which is the schematic phase. The schematic phase involves taking information obtained from the programming phase and expanding on it. That involves doing schematic, as it states, schematic diagrams in nature, indicating volumes and locations of buildings on site, the number of buildings, the number of stories, and relationship between the buildings. As we move on to the next phase, the design development phase, is it takes the schematic design documents and expands upon them into more detailed documents, which includes doing more detailed layouts of the buildings themselves. You have detailed openings into the buildings. You have restrooms laid out, You have your classrooms laid out, storage facilities, and all the components that would make up the particular buildings on site and independently. We do then elevations and sections. We start looking at all the different components and systems, the general systems, structural, mechanical, plumbing, electrical, and any other utility and systems. Upon completion of a design development process, we move on to the final stage of design, which would be the construction documents phase. And that takes all your documentation to date and puts it into documents that can be used for obtaining DSA approvals and then for bidding and building the actual project. The documents include specifications, detailed specifications that are prepared along the way but are finalized during the construction documents phase. Once everything is completed and the buy-in from the district is obtained, those documents are then taken to DSA and submitted for review and approval. Any questions on any of that process?
I have one question. Then where we stand right now, we're not even in the programming phase yet, right?
We are in the programming phase. Absolutely we are. We have, in fact, Betty Hanson will be talking about the ed specs, and then we've already obtained the topographic survey. We've gotten as-bills from the district. We've examined the as-bills, and we're using that information along with meetings. We had a community outreach meeting last week and obtained some input, valuable input from the community, and all that information is being put together to prepare the schematic documents that will be submitted.
Thank you.
Okay.
I have one question. You mentioned the community input, and you mentioned the community input that you got last week. Do you have a plan to get additional community input, and what is that plan?
Absolutely. We've had a couple meetings, and then we'll continue to have meetings. We have a gentleman here, Mr. Ralph Patterson, who's our outreach consultant. He's facilitating with the process as well as bringing in his experience being a former superintendent of schools. So we are doing additional meetings. They haven't been scheduled as of yet because we're taking the information obtained from last week's meeting. We're putting it together and disseminating that to the team. After we've done that, then we'll go back and reschedule additional meetings as required to continue the process.
I would like to add also that our public information officer, Gina Ward, has been really helpful also in the outreach program for future meetings to send out emails to all the parents, including the administrative staff at Oswalt. We had a great suggestion at the last week's meeting to also include the city of Walnut and their website to send the information for any future meeting for our local residents too. We do a great job of being able to reach out to our current students' parents because we have their email addresses or the phone numbers, but we don't have all the community members. So that was a great recommendation from last week's meeting that we plan to move forward with in future meetings.
Okay, at this time I'd like to introduce Ms. Betty Hanson, and she'll be talking about the educational specifications.
Board President, members of the board and staff, and so good to see you. And I'm here because I'm an educator to begin with, and then I got into this facility thing, and I see the value of what we need to do to make sure our architects design what's best for kids. And that's why I'm really here, to make sure that the children get what they need. The most important piece of a school, the biggest impact, is in the classroom, because that's where the kids spend most of their day. So we spend a lot of time working with the staff at the school and getting their input on what we feel is necessary for now and the future, what the classroom should look like. And learning is changing because of the technology for the most part. Children are not the lecture kind of kids. They don't like that as much. So we know that we have to be responsive to their needs and how they're learning these days. And we've really worked very closely with the principal and teachers and department chairs and so on to get an understanding of what you see now and where you need to go. And that's hard to do when you don't have the technology that you'd like to have. But we try to bring this visionary process to them. So this is the first place we look, is what goes on in the classroom. We spent most of our time on that. Then we expanded beyond that. What are the other needs that you have? So we look at the multipurpose room, the cafeteria, the shade shelters, the library, the administrative office. All these things are very important for students and how the whole campus functions. We look at what doesn't work now, because we have the advantage of having a campus there to say, this is not what we want to see again. And then what can we do with a constrained site that we have, because we can't buy more acreage. We're stuck with what we have, and it's a very challenging site. So we're taking all these pieces together and coming up with an educational program specification. That's very important, because then that brings a guideline for the architects to begin the drawing. And that's kind of the process we're going through, and we're in, you know, changing as we go, and it's a fluid process, but it is something that's necessary so that we have a standard. And we believe that the standard's important, because we don't want to build the Taj Mahal better than any other school, but yet we don't want something that's below standard either. So we're trying to get that happy medium, and then take into consideration the playgrounds, the parking, the traffic. All these things are necessary to incorporate along with the educational program. So that's the process we've been going through, and getting a lot of input from all the staff and community, and a lot of the support from the district office as well. So we believe we're getting very close to where we need to go on that. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay.
I have one question. As you heard the other night, and you'd hear it at all the other school sites, that pick up and drop off is a big issue at our school sites. And that's something that really needs, you know, community input and attention.
Yes.
The other thing is, later tonight we're going to be getting a presentation on energy conservation.
Mm-hmm.
How does that fit into the overall design?
Well, I do you want me to answer it? Okay. Well, first of all, there is a requirement from the Division of State Architect that you have energy-efficient materials and design within the school. It is very energy-efficient, so we know number one, have to, just to get it approved by the state architect's office. As well, we want to do it, because those are the efficiencies that we want to bring, not only because it'll save money for the school district on energy usage, but it's good for our environment, and it's good learning process for the students. So I think all those are very important things. Go ahead and embellish on that one.
I just wanted to add that it's also a requirement from the California Building Code to do energy, and also the California Green Building Standards Code. So we'll be using those requirements as well as everything that we've learned over the years. Additionally, I wanted to add to the traffic issues that we have a traffic consultant, a traffic engineer, that's working on preparing a study and report that we'll be using for the design of the parking lot up front, in front of the school, and the drop-off, pick-up and drop-off areas with their recommendations. So we are conscious of the issues that are there and are working with the proper consultants.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, they're not able to attend tonight, so there won't be anyone here.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
At what point do you work on sound within each classroom, you know, the acoustics, that type of thing?
When we move on from design development, between design development and construction document, is when we start getting the other consultants involved, the more technical If we're doing a theater, we get the theater consultant, acoustical engineers, and so forth. So we're still early enough. We don't really talk about the minute, the specifics as to the outlets in the classrooms yet, because we're still working with volumes, general building concepts. As we get further in the development between design development and construction documents, it's when we get that input.
The reason why I ask is because I know with the new building at Oswald, the ceilings are that metal ceilings, and it's, you know, it just echoes off of everything. And I'd hate to put that much money into a brand new campus and have that be a basic flaw.
I understand, and we will be looking at different systems and methods of construction.
And then some of our classrooms, when I've gone around looking, some of them have this variable seating so the kids can configure themselves in different ways. Some kids like to sit on the floor to do their work. Some like, you know, and it's not every class, but I would assume that it would take an open, kind of an open center area so that the teachers can adapt.
Yes, we've had some discussions in regards to that, and cooperative and learning environment. So we are looking at different options. Again, that is a little bit further in the design process, right, when we start actually doing the diagrams, laying out the classrooms and the seating arrangements and the type of furniture that the district will be selecting as well.
Sorry to be jumping ahead, but The other thing to think about early is air conditioning and cooling and fans and that kind of thing.
I understand. And as I said, it's one of the systems that get looked at during the design development process.
Thanks.
Just to piggyback on Ms. Evenkamp's comment, when we did some previous construction, we had all the teachers get together, and they came up with this magic wall, or what do you want to call it, for all the classrooms. Are we going to continue that same concept, you know, with the sliding whiteboards and the storage?
It's called a learning wall.
Learning wall.
And that has been part of the discussions.
Yeah. So do we continue with that over there, or do we redesign the learning wall?
It's in discussions at this time, so I don't have the answer yet, but we have discussed that. And there's a new technology nowadays, too, that wasn't available a few years back, so that we're looking at that as well.
Great. Thank you.
I agree with you. The design of what the kids need, but don't forget the teachers and staff. We need the place in the school for teachers so they can rest or they can study or they can learn, or they can facilitate like a teacher's lounge or something, because the teachers, they don't have their own office or their room. Sometimes they need a place for the quiet place for them,
right,
to think, to do their work, and not in classroom.
Right, and as Betty Hansen stated, she does the educational specifications, which have the minimum requirement from the state to be able to design a campus. Additionally, we meet with the users, and we get their input, and we work together as a team to come up with all the spaces that are required and that accommodate for all the different functions. So that's definitely in the discussion process as well.
Last question. At the parents' meeting, community meeting that you had, there seemed to be confusion with people in the audience about the plot design and the building design. And I think it's important that they understand the difference, because some of them thought that the plot design could be applied to the buildings that you're putting in these new buildings, and they didn't want to double pay.
Right. If I recall correctly, they were making reference to a site plan.
Site plan.
And a site plan is one document that makes up the entire set of documents that are used at the end of the project for the approvals and construction process. The site plan that was presented that they were making reference to was a conceptual site plan several years ago that was considering doing different buildings on site. Somehow, during the process, the other buildings were descoped from the project and ended up being a one-building project, but the infrastructure that supported additional buildings in the future was put in place. So when we are designing the campus, the full campus, we're taking into account that the infrastructure is already in place for these future buildings, and we're working with that to prepare a new site plan that encompasses new buildings on site.
Also, I believe there was a lot of infrastructure work that was done in the previous modernization that site plan was used if I'm correct.
That is correct.
And I also want to, there was a misconception that we were paying for a site plan again. We are not paying for any site plan. We are paying for the construction of that building and the planning of it. It's 8.5% of the construction costs. So we're not paying for a site plan or for the plans. It's for the entire project, and it's 8.5% of construction costs.
And it's the entire process from design through construction of the project and close out.
Is there any discussion or thought about having any of the new buildings with a connection to the one existing new building in the back, the science building?
We're thinking about it, obviously, because it is a building that will be remaining on site.
Right.
So we have to look at different solutions, how we can incorporate all the different buildings, the new buildings, and the existing building as well.
Whether it be an actual connection or even a walkway that's covered and sheltered from the rain.
So that is part of the design process that we will be working on.
There are some constraints back there because there's a lot of infrastructure below the ground. That might be very very expensive and very difficult to do, but they'll consider everything. I think one of the concerns that came up in the meeting last week is the lack of restrooms in that building.
Exactly.
So that's one of the things that we have discussed with the architect as one of our interests is to have some dedicated restrooms in one of the nearby buildings that will be built there. So that'll be dedicated for that building that didn't have the restrooms.
I'm just thinking if there's a sheltered, covered area that they could walk under if it's raining to get to those restrooms.
For the information meeting, the material, the slides you showing to the stakeholders, are they available before meeting or are they see it? At the meeting, because the reason I ask is if we give them, the people have time to review it, to think, so that we can get more input.
They can be available. Mm-hmm. We have had some changes, last minute changes that we've made to some of the presentation slides, mm-hmm. but we can certainly work with the district to put together whatever documents mm-hmm. are required and find out what the timing so that we can get them out ahead of time.
Absolutely. The other thing that we did for this last presentation mm-hmm. is we first presented it. Kevin presented the information at a PTA meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So he shared the information. They had a lot of conversation about mm-hmm. interest to start the conversation going.
Right.
And then the presentation night where we had the architects and everyone was just held.
Mm-hmm.
And there were small group discussions to mm-hmm. be able to be had. So it wasn't all there was a lot of two-way conversation and participation.
Because mm-hmm.
If you just hand it out in advance, people think, oh, that's all that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We wanted them to come because we needed to hear from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then those that weren't able to come, as Alex has already said, Gina's done an excellent job creating a document to get additional communication mm-hmm. and feedback from those that weren't able to be there,
okay.
to be present in person.
All right.
And as Ms. Hansen stated, it is a fluid process. So even if we provided the documents, you know, a week before, we're still working and changing and evolving. So, again, keep in mind that that's not what you get. It's not your final product until we get the construction documents completed.
I would like to thank Jorge for his presentation on this project. We have Bob Price now from the same firm that will be speaking about the Nogales project, if it's okay with the board.
We need to change our PowerPoint. This will take a second. Sure. Good evening, everyone. It's nice to be here. I'm here to present two projects that we're designing at Nogales High School. As you can see, Building H, which is the music building, and Building F, which is a small theater and classrooms. These are replacement buildings. There are existing buildings in the same spot as we're building these, and we will be demolishing those buildings, and we will be giving you a brand-new building that is more suitable for your present needs. So this first slide shows artist rendering of the outside of these buildings. Let me just begin by showing you the existing site as it is. I think most of you are pretty well aware of this. This is Nogales Street. Northam Street is down here. These are the newer buildings that make up the Revival Project. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, we'll start looking on this side now. Okay, so the existing site, these are the brand new buildings, fairly new buildings. They were opened 2 or 3 years ago, and they're beautiful buildings by HMC. Our buildings are sort of bookends to these buildings. This is the building H, which is the band and choral building that we will be demolishing. This building is about 55 years old. Our other building, Building H, is this one down here, which is, it has the same footprint as the adjacent classroom buildings, but it has a small theater. It's about 110 seats right here, and then it's got 10 relatively small classrooms on this side right here. So what I'm trying to show you is the present juxtaposition between the existing buildings and the new buildings. I also want to point out that this is a covered area for students where they can sit and wait to be picked up. This is part of the Revival building. It's a diagonal wall, and that has some bearing on the new project. This next site plan is artist rendering of the site one more time. This is Nogales Street. Northam Street is right here. These are the new buildings that comprise the Revival Project. This is a rendering of the building we're proposing for the band room and for the chorus. It's Building H. And then down here is Building F, which we put in an angle to be congruent with all these other buildings. It's got a small theater, which has about 180 seats in it. And then we have 7 regulation size classrooms. The current 10 classrooms in this building are not regulation size. They're like 700 to 800 square feet, and that does not meet the state regulations. So we placed as many classrooms in this area as we could, and it amounted to 7, and each classroom is 960 square feet. I also want to point out that at each of these sites, there are some soil issues, some subsurface issues. If you look at the existing building, this, of course, is not the existing building. This is our proposed building. There is a crack in the adjacent sidewalk that opens and closes seasonally based upon the amount of moisture that's in the soil. So we're talking about a clay soil. And over here, we have a similar problem with the existing building, not with this. These are issues that we're going to address in the new project. But if you go inside, let me go back to the last slide. If you go inside this building right here, there's a longitudinal crack all along here inside the building. In other words, what's happening is this portion of the existing building is settling rapidly. So you have 2 different rates of settlement in this building. So this building essentially is not being used by Nogales at the present time, and it'll soon be demolished so we can build our new building. Okay, this is what Building H looks like currently. This is the music building. This is it right here. You can see beyond. You can see the existing large parking lot, and we're viewing the building from the campus side. One of the major problems with this building currently is that the 2 programs, chorus and band and even orchestra, have outgrown the building. It's too small for them. But the biggest problem, as far as the band side is concerned, is that there's not enough storage for instruments. So what you're seeing here, this is their existing storage. You can see this, the instruments are just, you know, there's not enough room for all of them, and they're storing a lot of them on the floor inside the band rehearsal room. And then every one of the practice rooms that they have currently is full of, you've got string instruments here, you've got brass instruments here, and then you have music stored there. So they have a definite storage issue. They also have two large bins. This is the smaller of the two bins that's full of more band stuff. Now, we are not going to be able to accommodate the stuff that's in the bins. They will have to continue to be stored elsewhere. And we're thinking that north of our site, there's going to be another project that will be for the new swimming pool and the dressing rooms. And we're thinking that master planned into that could be some sort of permanent building for band storage. This is just a floor plan of the existing band building. I won't belabor it too much, but this is the extent of the band building. Both floors of the rehearsal rooms, this is the chorus side, this is the band side. They're both tiered, and neither director wants a tiered floor, so what we're giving them is a flat floor. But you can see this was the extent of instrument storage when this was originally constructed. And currently, the band is using that as their color guard storage. So the only storage they have currently is in cabinets here, and then every one of these practice rooms is full of instruments, unfortunately. So this is the plan. One thing I didn't mention is in the last plan, the existing building is 4,800 square feet. We're enlarging that to 8,000 square feet, so we're increasing the footprint by about 65%. But the layout of the building is pretty much the same. You have band on this side. You have the choral rehearsal room on this side. There are practice rooms. Each side will have a music storage library. As I said, currently, at least on the band side, the music is stored all over the place, unfortunately. And then this area right here is going to be lockers for instrument storage. We took an inventory of the instruments, the band instruments, and the orchestra instruments. We worked with a vendor who manufactures standard modular lockers for instruments, and they came up with a layout for us. It doesn't show on this drawing, but all the band instruments and the orchestral instruments will be in lockers, and each one will have a hasp on it that the individual student can lock. We also have a preliminary landscape plan for the band room, and this is our second iteration of that. The first iteration had quite a bit of planting over here, and after having a discussion with Dr. Mitchell, we pulled that back considerably. We also added a sidewalk here, a sidewalk there, and we're looking at a waiting area for students. This right now, currently, this is sort of an area where a lot of students sit and stand and wait to be picked up by their parents at the end of the day. What I'm proposing is that we put benches along this area here, and it'll be a nice place for students to wait to be picked up. Plant palette matches the palette of the existing planting that has been done for the revival project. So the colors you see here will be the same colors that you'll see blooming on the campus throughout the year. So this is how we foresee the new facility. This is what you would see from the parking lot, and this is what you would see from the campus side. This slide is unfortunately a little bit dark, but we took our cues in terms of the exterior design from the existing revival building, particularly from the administration building, which I think is the most attractive building on the site currently. We'll be matching the exterior materials. This is a stucco, and it will have a steel braced frame. It'll be identical construction to the existing. This is the adjacent food services building. And you'll see in a second when I show you the animation, you will see how well our buildings blend in with the existing buildings. This is how we are seeing the choral rehearsal room, and this they had requested a mirror. This is something that a lot of choral rehearsal rooms at high schools use right now to help them practice and to not only practice their singing but also practice their movements for performance. Now, we do have this. Right now, we are considering this open ceiling. I heard the comment from the board member about Oswalt. What we would like, the reason we're leaving this open, it has acoustical benefits from the standpoint that it's going to be as high as possible. We will need the volume for acoustical. We're also looking at an acoustical deck, a metal deck. I've started working with an acoustician on this project, and he's very comfortable with this sort of construction. That concludes Building H. I'd like to go to Building F now, and what you're seeing here is the existing Building F. This is, of course, from campus side. This is the building. It looks just like all of the older classroom buildings on campus, and this picture is interesting from the standpoint that you can see some of the revival buildings also. This is the two-story building with administration on the first floor, classrooms on the second floor, and this is the two-story classroom building. And then there's this nice courtyard in between these two classrooms, and this is our Building H currently right now. This is the other side. This is what you would see from the northern side. And I'd point out this wall and this covered area for students to wait in a shaded, comfortable area to be picked up at the end of the day. This is our Building H from that side. And if you go about halfway down through this door, you see the big crack in the floor that's maybe 3 or 4 feet inside the exterior wall. So this portion of the building is settling pretty quickly. As far as the little theater is concerned, this is what the theater will look. It looks like currently. Our theater will have more seats. This is about 110, 115 seats. We're going to 180 seats. Our theater will be fully accessible. This theater is accessible up to a point. It's got the lift in it. But what we're giving is a larger stage, a larger audience area, a higher ceiling. This is a floor plan of the existing building. I don't think we need to look at it too long. I'm going to jump right to the proposed plan. So again, this building is sitting at a slight angle with respect to Northam Street, which is down here like this. And so what we're looking at is, like I said, this is an accessible, fully accessible building. The existing building is not, the control rooms are not accessible. For ours, we have a ramp that leads up to the control rooms so that somebody in a wheelchair can do the manipulations of the lighting and the sound. We've got a sound lock here on either side. This is the main entrance for people to come in. We have a nice, generous, comfortable seating area. This ramp down, this drops 24 inches, so this is all accessible. And we've allowed spaces for wheelchairs to park themselves. And we also have a lift onto the stage. In the back, we have a single-use toilet room, and we have a little green room. And then we also have a pair of doors to allow any kind of moving in and out of sets. We had a meeting last week with users for this project, and the uses that they suggested or that they said they would be utilizing the building for, it would be a parents' night, it would be staff meetings, drama rehearsals, small productions, and perhaps even small choral events. Here are the seven classrooms. They're 960 square feet each, which is the regulation size. We have bathrooms. This is what the code tells us, the number of fixtures we need to have. It's also accessible from either side. In fact, after hours, this part of the building could be used separately. We simply secure these doors and those doors there. Now, this project we don't have full approval on, and we're still working with the principal. There are a couple of issues that he brought up that he wanted to explore and decide on, and one was he wasn't sure he wanted this corridor down the middle. He was thinking about putting the classrooms together along a common wall and then have exterior doorways. That's exactly the layout for most of these older buildings. The newer classroom buildings are built more like this, and that's what this was designed with this building in mind. So this is something yet to be resolved, and there may be some more manipulation here. One of the teachers wanted an additional staff restroom. All the teachers that we met with, there were about 12 teachers in the group, love the idea of a staff workroom, sort of a remote staff workroom. So we are not fully approved on this project, but we're moving forward rapidly so that in hopes that we can complete the construction documents on both Building H and Building F so that we can submit it to DSA at the same time under a single number. So this is how we're looking at the exterior of this building. You know, again, we picked up the flavor of the existing buildings. This shows you a little bit. This is the existing two-story building, classrooms on top, admin on the bottom. We want to use the same colors, the same materials, the same feel, the same sort of modernist feel. And again, I was taking cues from the administration building, which I find is the most interesting building on campus, particularly the large conference room, which has the glass-cornered, the glass that comes together at the corner. Is just, I find it very appealing. Okay, so I'm going to show you the animation, and then I can entertain questions and comments. This is a video that our folks in the office put together using the existing buildings and the our building all put together to show a full composition. Of course, is our music building, seen from the campus, with the food services adjacent to it. Room now. This is the chorus side. Building H, I'm going to see Building F. We're moving down the center of the campus towards the south, past multipurpose on the left. We're heading towards Building F. Building F. Concludes it.
I want to thank Mr. Price for his presentation. Before we go to some questions, I also want to thank the energy and time he's placed into speaking to the staff members at Nogales High School. It's been a long process. As all of our district members are very passionate about what they do and the programs that they have at Nogales, there was a lot of interest for their buildings and to make sure they had a building that's going to meet the needs of our kids. And there was a lot of meetings that took place and a lot of back and forth conversations, all within making sure that we were within our budget. And that was one of the first conversations that we had. And we had to go back a couple times and say, this is not going to be within our budget. So we need to really be realistic in our design. So there were some hard conversations and there were, we made something, a really good program we're really excited about. I also want to thank our consultant because the conditions of the Building F with the crack and it's unusable, we are exploring options to actually secure some funding from the state regarding that so we can help offset some of the costs and save some bond money for that. So we're working together as a collective team, and I want to thank them for all their efforts for what they've done. And I do agree with Mr. Price that all of Nogales High School is flattering. It looks great. And it'll be a great addition to the new two buildings to the new existing buildings that we have there. Thank you.
Questions and comments?
I have about five questions.
Okay.
First of all, on Building F, mm-hmm. where you said that the classrooms did not meet code as far as square footage.
That's correct.
If we would take the corridor, the central hall, out mm-hmm. and dedicate that space to the classrooms and have exterior entrances, mm-hmm. would that additional space from the corridor make those classrooms legal then?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, you got classrooms on both sides. Huh?
In the drawing, it's legal.
These classrooms.
Yeah.
Can you ask your question one more time?
Okay.
The new design.
Let him ask
with the corridor going down the middle.
Yes.
Now you said that there was also some consideration of putting exterior entrances.
That's correct.
If you eliminated that corridor down the middle.
Yes.
And use that space for the classrooms.
Uh huh.
That would give you some additional square footage for each classroom then.
That's correct. We could make the classrooms larger.
Would that then bring it into compliance?
Well, the design we're giving you, the seven classrooms are 900. Each one is 960 square feet, which is the legal. It's the correct size. The ones that are not correct are the existing classrooms.
Oh, okay.
Which are somewhere between 700 and 800 square feet. Those are not really legal.
Okay, so the new ones would be then.
That's right. Absolutely. I'm sorry if I was misunderstood.
Well, let me go back to the same question.
Okay.
How much more square footage would we get in each classroom if we eliminated the corridor?
I would say...
How wide is it?
150 square feet, maybe? Something like that? We would definitely make a larger classroom if that's what you want, but if we do put the classrooms together and eliminate the corridor, we can't add another classroom because the building is going to be just as long as it was before.
Right, I understand that.
But if you want larger classrooms, we can do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's an option.
I think
absolutely.
I want to make a clarifying point. So we do not have any classrooms in our district that are illegal classrooms.
Okay.
So we have no illegal classrooms in our district. When you're building to current standard, 960 square feet is the standard size classroom. We have classrooms that are smaller than 960 square feet on our campuses, and they are for special designed purposes. So I wanted just to make sure that the audience and the board understands we do not have illegal classrooms.
Okay.
Okay, I'm just thinking that might be a consideration. By having the classrooms bigger, if that's something that the teachers and this, you know, the administration would want. The other thing is that creates a dead end hallway, right?
No,
there's only one entrance
out
of that hallway.
No, if you eliminate the corridor altogether, you will have all of your entrances on the outside.
Right, but the
it
way
won't create a dead end corridor.
The way it's shown right now.
Uh-huh.
There's no entrances outside, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Except at the ends of the corridors.
Right. Right, at the ends of the corridors.
Yeah. We would not design a building with dead-end corridors.
Okay. Okay. So where the theater is, you can exit out there also.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. The other thing is I realize we're limited to what it is. but the H building, which is the music building, choral building.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they would be making a lot of use of the F building, yet they're at extreme ends of the campus.
Right.
But I guess that's something we just have to live with.
Currently, I believe that the music performances take place in the multipurpose room. And I believe there's some issues acoustically with
Correct.
That building, but they're being studied currently, and I believe they're going to be addressed, so that will be a performance space. The building F will be a small performance space, and when we do the drawings on that, we will hire an acoustician, actually for both buildings, so that both of the rehearsal rooms will be tuned correctly, and so will the small theater.
Okay, and then building F, the small theater off of Northam.
Yes.
People would be parking in the parking lot along Nogales. What's the path that one would take to get to the ticket office?
It's actually very easy to get there. Let me see if I can show you. Let's see. The tech guy.
The existing footprint, it's the same that we use to get to the theater currently. So you park in the main parking lot, you
park
through the gate by the administration office, walk straight, it'll be on your left-hand side.
Okay.
So there's no entrance to it from, you can go ahead now, Bob.
So it'll be right through here. See, there's a big opening here. This is where a lot of the students enter the campus. And here, of course, is the parking. Here's our building.
Okay.
It'll be a straight shot.
Okay. I just know that when we go to the gym now, it's a challenge. Because they leave only that one gate open, and it's a challenge to walk to the gym to get to performances, especially at nighttime.
Part of that will change when the H building is done.
Yeah.
The entrance and exits to campus will be altered where that is now. We haven't changed any of the fencing in that area, so some of that will change. Because there is a straight shot from the area between the H building and the pool to walk down that corridor. We are always entering the gym through the back door of the stairs. The front doors are on the other side.
Yeah. I just know that sometimes that chain link fence is open, sometimes it isn't.
Right.
I walk down there, and then the fence is closed,
and
have to go around.
Yeah.
The storage in Building H?
Yes.
You said it would not accommodate the storage that's in those metal bins?
The storage in the new building will accommodate all of the instruments.
What's in those storage, those big metal storage bins?
All kinds of stuff. There is the uniforms, for one thing. We were hoping to get the uniforms into our building, but the instruments took precedence. So they're gonna either have to stay in one of the bins, or they're gonna have to be remotely stored somewhere else. All kinds of stuff that I couldn't even begin to explain.
I can explain it. Okay. So you have within there's they do field show tournaments. So there's field show tournaments that include what they do when they compete for the band. So there are racks for the drums and equipment to be able to be taken in and out of. So there's some equipment that they don't use on a daily basis. There are all of the uniforms are stored in one of those bins as well. And you have color guard equipment. You have drumline equipment. You have field show equipment, so it is a very there's significant amount of wear and or equipment that is needed, and they're also stored in their traveling trailer. So you see outside, it's a little more prominent outside. Of Roland High School has a big trailer,
right.
So they have items that are stored because there just is not. One whole building could be filled with treasures that exist. The other part, when you look at instrument storage. Is the students store them during the day often. They don't carry them around from classroom to classroom. But like a book, they bring them home to use to practice and return. There are some pieces of equipment that they don't bring home every day, so they're not carting large pieces of equipment each day. But it was very important in the work that was done to the band director is to make sure that there was adequate storage so that for the equipment and for the music itself. Because we have multiple file cabinets that are storing music, and to have it in one location in the room would be very helpful.
We are excited about the additional space for our students for their band activities and choral activities. And we are going to look in future projects that are adjacent to that area to see if there's any additional space that we could do some storage in the future projects that are going to be adjacent to that area by the pool.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question on building F.
Okay.
The small theater, there's no makeup room or change room. And, but the solution is if we can switch the restroom to the other side, because sometimes they can use the restroom for makeup or changing or
true.
That purpose.
I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
So in the possibility, we can just switch the classroom with the bathroom to this.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing in terms of any kind of makeup room or dressing room. Mm-hmm. If they're required, they could use those bathrooms. But I see what you're saying in terms of maybe flipping it to the south side mm-hmm. instead of the north side, mm-hmm. and we'll take a look at that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Compared to the existing theater and the new theater, what's the capacity difference? Is it more seats or less?
More seats. Mm-hmm. There's about 115 existing, and we're going to have about 180. So it's roughly in the same area of seats, but we're giving you more seats.
Okay. But we have less number of classrooms because the size.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
We've given you as many as we can. We've just said that.
I have two areas I want to ask you about.
Okay.
First is going back to that ceiling that I asked you about
yes.
and the acoustics.
Yes.
I know you've hired an expert.
Yes.
But we were overwrought with change orders on the first,
okay.
some of the first work.
Okay.
My concern is we take the expert's advice and we put these in and we find they're awful. So what happens then? I'm just saying, what if? It's kind of a what if.
Yes. I'm not that familiar with the type of deck that was used on the Oswald project, but I don't
think it was.
You
could probably look in the multi-purpose room at Nogales.
Okay.
We have the same problem there.
Okay.
If I can just add, I spoke to Marcos regarding the Nogales project. I don't believe that we commissioned, the architect commissioned any any acoustic engineer for the multipurpose room. So I think that's one of the reasons why that we're doing that after the fact to address the issue. But just the great thing about it, that's a question that came up with this project, that once the design is kind of getting closer, then the acoustic engineer will come in to look at the little theater to make sure that the acoustics are going to be sufficient. They're going to work for the design that's been developed for the little theater and also classrooms, I believe, too. So that's part of the process that we're going to make sure that happens with these projects.
Okay. And this other one, part of the questioning might be for Alex, but together you can work on it. What have we done to prevent some of the change order problems that we had with the prior work? How are you what are you doing to try to I know you can't guarantee, but just to try to more carefully prevent some of them?
No, absolutely. That's a great question because we don't want change orders, but we know that that's a reality.
Right.
We're far from that because we're still at the design stage. But once the designs are created and DSA approved, then we'll do a constructability and review of the plans again. So to make sure that everything is done, and I think at our next portion of the presentation, the Roland Addition Project, they can share about the 1,500 different changes we did after we had the plans returned back from DSA that have avoided change orders, because those would have been change orders if they were not caught beforehand. Because once it goes to bid, that is what we are going to pay for, and if there's changes, we would be responsible for it.
One of the things also that helps with eliminating change orders is involving the stakeholders early on in the process, which we've done, so that we can accommodate as much of the uses and the needs for the spaces in our construction documents in our process. So a lot of the change orders that happen on projects are because they didn't think about something early on, and it was a last-minute decision. So that's being done. That is the process that we go through in all of these projects.
And for this project in particular, we're concerned about the soil.
Yeah.
So, for example, there was about 20 samples that were taken for the previous project in Nogales. At Roland High School, we did like 140 soil tests. Marcos, was it 140?
It was about 100.
About 100 total of soil samples. And we're going to do extensive soil testing in some areas where there is an existing building. We may do some deconstruct to do some soil testing because it's not being used in that building F. We'll tear apart a little section of it to do some soil sampling there because we want to make sure that if there's anything beforehand, we know.
What's the say if our auditorium has a sellout night, 180 people, what's the requirement for bathroom facilities for a theater like that?
Well, the plan that I've shown you has already done the research into the plumbing code. And there is a specific way of calculating it for places of assembly, like theaters and auditoriums and that sort of thing. But what I've done is I did the research into the plumbing code to determine the required number of fixtures, and I've exceeded it by a little bit, by a couple of fixtures on each side.
Because it looks like there's four on one and two on the other. You know, four in the women's bathroom and looks like two plus two urinals on the men's.
Let me get there.
Jeez. 180 people. I guess you wait.
There's five.
Is it five?
Couldn't be a handicap one.
Oh, at the end there, yeah. A handicap one at the end. Yeah, there's a handicap one at the end.
Yeah, on the female side, there are one, two, three, four, five toilets, four lavatories, and then three toilets on the men's side and two urinals and three sinks. Are you questioning that that's not
enough? I'm just thinking if there's 180 people.
Yeah. Well, we can add more. I think we have a little bit of room there.
Well, the reality is maybe that code, we meet the code, but the reality is, as you said, 180 people, and isn't performing, and they all go to the bathroom at the commission.
Yes. Yes.
So is there any adjacent bathroom in the next building?
There is an adjacent bathroom in the administration building that has an exterior opening. And there is also one in the two-story classroom building. There are two sizable bathrooms. Yeah, in two of the adjacent buildings.
It's just as you get older, these come to your thinking.
I just wanted to add to there is a budget that we need to comply with, and there's also a limitation as far as the size of the building that we can build on.
Yeah.
So we have to take everything into account. If we add additional restrooms or additional stalls, means taken away from somewhere, either a classroom or reducing the size of your theater. So we need to consider all these items when we're designing. And again, as Bob stated, we're still working through this design process to refine it. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, I would like to call Larry or Russ from Ledesma Meyer to provide a brief presentation on the Roland Addition Project.
Good evening, board members, Madam President, Dr. Mitchell. Mr. Flores has asked me to come back and give you an update for the Roland High School project, which I'm glad to do. I am Russ Hall, your site superintendent from Ledesma Meyer Construction. I think some of you folks have heard or seen some of this information before, so I'll keep it brief and kind of prune it down to basically a update. Which one of these buttons forwards? There it is right there. Okay. For the project overview, it's a singular bid project awarded to one contractor, which is ACC. The project was awarded on June 14th of 2016. Construction began a week later, June 21st, 2016, with the completion date of September 2nd, 2019. We have three phases. We have a new classroom building scheduled to finish this summer. Phase two, which is starting this summer, and phase three is to take place in the summer of 2019. For a general project description, it's a three-phase project to take place over 3 years. The work scope includes the demo of the existing administration building, library, and H buildings, and the demo of all portable buildings on campus. New construction is the following. We have a two-story, 22-classroom building, which is done in phase one. That's currently what we're working on right now. There is a two-story admin library building in phase two, performing arts center and kitchen facility in phase two, special education building in phase two, ASB building in phase two, and the main parking lot, which takes place in phase three. Phase one current status is that the site preparation tasks are complete. The new classroom building is in the finishing stages and on schedule to be ready for a move-in this summer. The existing in-building modifications have begun for the relocation of the band department, and plans are approved for the temporary hideout portable trailers, which are relocated east of the new classroom building once the school is out. To be more specific, those trailers will be set on June 12th, so they're ready to come out. Once we give them the green light, that is. I'm just going to flip through some slides. This is a clearing of the pad when we first began. This was the digging of the foundations for the new classroom building. Here's the foundations being formed and being poured with concrete. I'm not going too fast for you guys, am I? And there's a new classroom steel erection in the beginning phases. And this is the steel erection as it had progressed a little further. You can see that the separation walls, the partition walls, are being infilled with steel studs here. This is the building I was, it was wrapped for the plaster procedure with the scaffolding being set up. This is a picture I took the other day of one of the interior staff rooms. I think this was the first floor. You could see the progress for the T-bar ceilings and the lights are going in. This picture I took about a week ago or so. This is a exterior picture from the east looking to the west. It mirrors this slide here, which is the architectural rendering for the building, which we've referenced to on other presentations. Okay, we have a busy summer this year. and we have a lot of what we call make-ready summer work. Some of those items, key items, are that we are to convert the portable buildings, P1 through P6, for the relocation of the administration staff prior to the start of school. The administration staff right now will be leaving and packing up this weekend. We'll be moving over to Alvarado, and they'll be moving back over to the Roland High School project, hopefully as soon as summer school is out. And I think your last day of summer school is the, I think it's the 5th of July or thereabouts. We're going to convert the existing C building to serve as a temporary library facility until the completion of the new library building is complete in the winter of 2018. We're going to demo portables P7 through P10 and set the food service trailers there. Those are temporary food service trailers in the location until the new kitchen facility is complete the summer of 2019. So we'll be demoing and removing those trailers as soon as possible, probably start sometime next week, actually. We will be setting a temporary hideout portable building east of the new classroom building. That's the trailer I just spoke about earlier. That building will be set up to take place of the functions that currently take place in the H building hideout. It's a gathering or NPR location. It'll be three trailers that are put together without any interior walls and just one open space, basically. We will be energizing the temporary low-voltage head-in building and bring online the new administration, until the new administration building is complete in the winter of 2018. We will be fencing off the construction areas for upcoming work zones, including the northern section of the main parking lot. And just as a note, access to the gym and pool will remain available. So basically, we're going to go into the parking lot there and take the northern third of the parking lot and fence that off for our what we would call construction laydown zone for the next upcoming phase. The JAR building will be closed until the end of the project. Basically, it's being closed due to the fact that we do have to deal with the existing cafeteria and provide over excavation for the new theater kitchen building, installation of new site underground lines, and flatwork improvement there. So right now the cafeteria is currently connected to your JAR building. When we're done, we'll be resurfacing the outside of that JAR building as an exterior wall, and it'll leave a pedestrian walkthrough area and some flatwork improvements between the two buildings. Upcoming phase two construction, which is going to start Monday, we won't actually start demoing the existing H building on Monday, but the procedure for the phase will start, and so we can replace it with a new theater kitchen building. We'll be demoing the existing administration building to replace it with a new two-story admin building, library. We'll be demoing the existing library building and replace it with a new ASB building. We'll be demoing the existing cafeteria, relocating the construction laydown yard and northern portion of the main parking lot, which I just described. And we'll be constructing a new special education building after the admin building is complete in the winter of 2018. So the admin will be in the portables, P1 through P6, until the admin building is complete, and at which time, when they relocate into the admin building, we'll remove the portables and start the construction of the special ed building. And the final third phase of the project, which will happen in the summer of 2019, will be the demo of the existing main parking lot. We'll remove the temporary low-voltage head-in building since we won't need it anymore, and we'll finish the improvements in that area. We will construct the new main parking lot. We'll remove the existing portable buildings P13 through 26 and provide all new asphalt in that area. We will also remove the temporary hideout building and provide new asphalt. We will remove the temporary kitchen trailer and have a big party. Because by then we're done. So it's a brief update, but like I said, I know a lot of you folks have seen or heard some of this before, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions anybody has. We're extremely happy and proud of the progress we've made on the project so far. We feel that our budgetary constraints are in order. Dr. Mitchell gave us our marching orders in the beginning, and that was to be on time and on budget. We feel we've, to this point, accomplished those goals. And don't have anything really detrimental to report about the project at this time. But I would like to answer some questions if you have any.
Thank you.
I'll echo part of your conversation that work has been consistently going on because I drive back that way all the time,
oh, okay.
So I can see what's going
right.
on. Were you slowed down by the rain at all? Did it take you off schedule?
It did slow us down for certain procedures. We did add extra manpower to the project to expedite some of it. So we felt that was necessary because, as you know, our project was designed without the use of interim housing.
Yes.
And this building being up in time to move students in this summer was predicated on the success of the whole project. Without that, we would be telling a much different story tonight.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple questions. Before I say my couple questions, I want to say thank you for being on time. I know
yeah.
it's always a concern that we're not going to make it in the rain and all that.
It's a concern for everybody, and it's what drives us. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But we're glad it worked.
And it was wonderful to see it come to be. Mm-hmm. It was really nice to watch the process. The cafeteria. What's going to happen with the kids and food? Do you have any idea?
Well, do you mean in regards to the temporary facility?
Yes.
Okay. Over at Nogales High School, you had a temporary kitchen trailer. That temporary kitchen trailer has already been relocated to our campus. In addition to that, you had an ASB trailer. That trailer has been moved over to our campus. We're going to use the ASB trailer, which has 4 service windows, and the kitchen trailer, which also has 4 service windows, in conjunction with each other to give ourselves 8 service windows for the kitchen. And then we're moving over other items, such as their storage bin, and they have a little pizza kiosk, which we're relocating. So that is one of our first orders of business here next week when we move some of the portable buildings. We have a layout, which I've already shared with Maria Davila and Mitch Bruner, the principal there, and Marcos, myself, our directors, and everybody looked at it and came up with a reasonable layout. We think it'll work.
Okay, and go ahead.
To clarify, just I wanted to make sure that we addressed your question. I don't know, was it a... Did that address it, or was it about
for the
jar?
Students okay. to make sure that they
got it.
And my other one, the parking lot, what are you going to, do anything different or just fix it up?
Well, first of all, the parking lot will be taken over with the lay down area, which I described. We counted parking stalls and mapped that out in conjunction with approval with the principal. Mitch, he helped us out with that, and we shared how many spots would be available. So that's what the parking lot's going to look like during construction. Once the parking lot is done with the laydown area and we're going into that last summer, we have plans that are part of the project to put an all-new parking lot with improvements, all-new asphalt, wheel stops, drives, the whole thing.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll plan also to send some local letters to the local residents during football games. May be impacted, might be more parking in the streets, so we want to make sure we're good neighbors.
Yeah, I think we're still going to have 230 spots, if I'm not mistaken. And I noticed right now that the parking lot, I've never seen it full. Of course, I haven't been there on graduation. I'm just saying, for day-to-day student activities, it doesn't seem to fill up. So I think we'll be okay.
Since the Nogales, the soil problem, mm-hmm. a lot of clay layers, and what do you have? Sometimes you don't see it until you dig it out. And how's the soil condition underground of the this job site?
Well, we took initial boring tests mm-hmm. with the district. Marcos can attest to that. There was initial tests, and they came back in and took a secondary test. I think it might have been predicated because of what they found over at Nogales. So we beefed up some extra borings. Now, borings are only going to get you a picture of a vein. You're not going to get the whole site. Anything mm-hmm. could happen. I was there during your last modernization where we did a lot of the underground utility lines, kind of prep for what was coming up, not having the design yet, but in preparation for this phase that we're in currently or this project that we're in currently. We dug sewer lines down the center of the campus, 16 feet deep in some areas, and we didn't run into anything that we felt was too concerning. So I got my fingers crossed, and all I can say is I haven't seen anything to this point that would lead us to have concern. It is a fill site, meaning that back 50 years ago, there was soil brought into the site to the west end of it to level it. I think that soil, for the most part, was stable, but Yeah, we'll have to wait
and see. How thick is the soil layer? How thick?
How thick is the soil?
Yeah.
Well, the soil is never ending.
The picture is a bit thick. That's a,
I'm not sure I understand the question. Let me help out a little bit by saying that the footings for the buildings aren't overly deep. We're required to go to dig 3 feet past the depth of the lowest footing, and the lowest footing for the project is 5 to 6 feet. So we don't have to dig down too much more than 11 feet with the heavy equipment and then replace the soil through compaction. I don't know if that answers your question or not. I'm sorry.
The reason asked is the thickness of the soil.
You mean the density, maybe?
No, the thickness of the soil layer. And underneath the soil is a rock. So how, in this, the geology in this area, is about the same as here and Nogales because of the soil.
We haven't hit any bedrock. Yeah. And like I say, we did put a sewer line in that was 18 feet deep last summer, kind of right down the middle of the campus.
Right.
So how much fill is put on the soil? Right. As already stated, but we've already dug 16 feet deep.
16 feet,
still in the fill area. Mm-hmm. So we've not gotten down to bedrock at this point.
Right, so what happened 50 years ago, what you're saying, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think that was probably 25 feet or something of fill, maybe.
It was quite a bit on the east end.
Right. Mm-hmm. It tapers in a wedge. You know, it started off to make the hole. As it got closer to Otter Bean, it got deeper or thicker, I think, is what you're asking.
Okay.
The theater. You saw the one that Nogales is getting. Is this going to be similar to Nogales?
No. It's 615 seats.
Oh, 615. Yeah. Ooh. Okay.
Yeah, it's a full-blown production theater, performing arts theater, yeah.
It's a serious theater.
Yeah, it's a nice... that's a good number of theater seats. I've done a number of them in the past, and they, you know, usually vary somewhere between, you know, a couple hundred, but usually not much over 600. So it's a good size theater.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
This concludes the facility presentation. Climate Tech? Oh, okay.
Okay. Our second item is the Roland Unified School District Energy Conservation Program presentation. And I'd like to welcome Mrs. Pride, who was tied up at work.
Representatives from Climatech will provide a presentation of the work that has been completed to establish an energy conservation program and secure the $3.6 million RUSD is entitled to under Prop 39 grant funding. Yes. I made copies. Okay. The work has been extensive, involving several team members of the Administrative Service Unit. I would like to thank all the staff members from the Maintenance and Operations Department who assisted all the Climatech engineers, and also thank all the outstanding site members and principals who allowed teams of individuals to walk each and every campus in our district. At this time, I'd like Ashley Cassio, who will conduct the presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flores. Board President Emmett Camp, members of the board, Superintendent Mitchell, members of staff, and the Roland community, thank you for having us here tonight. We're really excited to share the culmination of our efforts over the last 6 months in working with staff to put together this program. Climatech was selected back in January of this year through a competitive RFP process that was conducted by the district to be the district's energy services provider. And over the last 6 months, we developed a utility baseline of the district's utility consumption and did detailed site assessments with our engineering team of each site, each piece of equipment, where there's inefficiencies in operational expenditures, and developed with staff's input over many meetings a scope of work that addresses those needs. And tonight we're going to present three different options at various levels of funding so the board can make an informed decision on how best to proceed with this energy conservation program. If you have any questions during the presentation, please feel free to stop us so this is interactive. We work with dozens of districts throughout Southern California in about 60 districts in the state for Proposition 39 programs. And although each district has unique needs, the objectives of the programs that we put together are generally solving the same types of problems. It's how to make the learning environment more comfortable and safe and address aging infrastructure that districts have, and ultimately how to contain the costs related to utility expenditures and operational expenditures to provide savings for the general fund, especially in today's economic climate. This covers a utility analysis. I've asked Sandeep Nayak, our Director of Engineering, to join me tonight to talk about utility analysis and different aspects of the scope of work.
Thank you, Ashley. So this slide, I won't take too much time, but this slide actually gives you a snapshot of how the district as a whole uses its energy, both gas and electric, and then it's broken down by each site, and we usually take different types of metrics. One of the metric would be using a dollar per square feet, because it would be an ideal measure way to measure each school, how it performs as compared to other schools. So if you look from the top graph, from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, you have the highest dollar per square foot or highest energy consumer at Telesis, food services, all the way down to Roland Elementary School, which is only $1.17, which is doing pretty well. The bottom graph actually shows you how the district consumes energy on a monthly basis, and it follows like lower energy consumptions during January, February, March, usually your cooler months, to really September when school is in session and when school really starts. You have all of the kids coming in, all the systems start at one time, as well as it's like your hottest month of the year as well, and you really have a high energy consumption. Here's a quick snapshot. As Ashley mentioned, there are three different options that we would be presenting today. I know there's a lot of information crammed into this one table. I'll just give you a quick legend of how to read it. Going from it's basically divided into three different color codes for the three different options. Option one is everything that is color coded in blue. Option two is blue plus all the scope items for in green, and option three would be all the three different colors. You have on the left-hand side, you have all the different schools. Each, we looked at every school, every site, and then the top column is really broken down into different types of energy-consuming types. So your mechanical, looks at all your air conditioning units, your furnaces, your heat pumps, all different types of air conditionings, your central plants. Lighting, it looks at interior lighting, all your classroom lighting, hallway lighting, to exterior lighting. And then water is on the right-hand side. Other measures, and we'll probably touch more on those, what those are. And then the very first column is what we call as the building automation system, or really the controls or the brains that control all your heating and air conditioning equipment as well as lighting.
So we'll dive into each of these categories a little bit here on the next few slides. So building automation systems, as Sandeep said, it's the backbone, the energy management system that controls the heating and cooling systems. And that's going to be one of the greatest areas for energy conservation in terms of being able to just make sure that units aren't running when students and staff are not in the room. And the district as a whole does a really good job with that. It has currently a building automation system, an energy management system that has a tremendous amount of useful life left in it. Most districts, when we go to, we put together these types of programs, they have a hodgepodge of different systems, or they simply don't work, or there's oftentimes you see rooms left running heating and cooling systems while they're unoccupied. Roland Unified doesn't have that issue. The problem that we heard when we were out at different sites and talking to M&O staff was simply that the system itself does what it's intended to do. However, it's an older technology, and it's a legacy type of system that doesn't have the ability to control and make adjustments remotely and be able to monitor from a remote location while staff is out at different sites. So when you have limited M&O resources that are serving the needs of all of your sites, that oftentimes leads to staff inefficiencies. So that was one of the greatest areas they were wanting to develop a solution. And so the building automation system that the district has the capability to have those functions. So this would upgrade the system to have web-based monitoring and be able for staff, M&O staff, to be able to control the heating and cooling units remotely. And ultimately what this will do is just improve the ability to respond to work orders and comfort issues much more quickly.
It actually also helps save energy by optimizing some of your schedules, because you, as he said, you actually mm-hmm. have a hodgepodge of systems, and you have central plants, like with chillers, your package of mechanical systems, that would actually allow you with the new control system to actually save more energy as well by optimizing the plants. So.
Lighting is another area that's going to be a big focus for this program. So for the grant funding that's available from the state, lighting is essential to be able to meet the payback requirements that are for that. And throughout the district, there's a mixture of interior and exterior fixtures, which are inefficient, older technology. Oftentimes, these provide poor light levels in the learning environment. And the bulbs for these type of older lighting systems have to be replaced often. So that means increased maintenance costs and M&O time, having to go out and change bulbs when they go out. So what this would do was upgrade anywhere from option 1, 2, and 3, various levels of different lighting scope. But in option 3, that would upgrade up to about 18,000 fixtures throughout the district, interior and exterior, all to LED, and provide substantial energy savings. And obviously, there's substantial enhancements that can be realized in the learning environment. And sometimes we hear concerns over if the LEDs are going to be too bright or hard on the eyes, especially in the learning environment. Sometimes it could be kind of harsh. But this technology and all of the solutions in each option that we have will have dimming capabilities to adjust to the individual needs of each room or space. Yes.
How often do you need to change them? Because you said the other one you have to change. You don't change them that often?
Yes. So with the new technology, it depends on the fixture. It varies from interior to exterior, but generally the bulbs last anywhere from 5 to 10 years. So, and they're warrantied as well. The HVAC systems is another focus for these type of programs. And Roland, again, has, compared to districts throughout the state, has done a very good job of staying on top of modernizing and upgrading its HVAC systems over the years. Oftentimes when we put these together, districts have, you know, sometimes 10 times the amount of units that need to be replaced, which is a significant burden to be able to address that type of deferred maintenance. But units are constantly aging out, so it's not to say that there's no needs out at the sites. There's a substantial amount of HVAC systems that are past their useful life, just less than you would see comparatively at a lot of other districts. One of the big focuses, though, that is a concern and a problem out at sites is the sites that have central plant systems. Those are very costly and large systems, difficult to replace and maintain. And there's a number of central plant sites that are needing to be upgraded, particularly the cooling towers that are failing. So this would address that in all three options. That's the big focus for the HVAC. And then any of the other package units or wall-mounted units that are heating and cooling units that are past their useful life, that's over 15 years old, are starting to become a maintenance burden, and are going to need to be replaced in the very near future, those would be addressed as well in various amounts depending on which option the district decided to move forward with.
I have a question.
Yes.
If you were to replace a unit, what's the life of the new type of units that you're liable to be putting in?
So for the just the standard package units that you see on a rooftop or the wall-mounted units, is 15 years. That's the industry standard. Central plant equipment generally is closer to 20. Yeah, 20 years for central plant equipment.
Do you have the number of the existing HVAC units? How old are they? I have impression some of them are quite new. They replaced them few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so your question was how many units are there, right, that are past 15 years old?
Or less than 5 years old. Some of the new, and we, yeah.
So as Ashley mentioned, I mean, the maintenance staff, facility staff have actually done a pretty good job of staying on top of it. I guess pretty good support from the board as well during the modernization. Typically, a district of this size, we would find a lot of units that would probably need replacement. To give you an idea of between the three options, the number of units that we found that were past their useful life, when I say past the useful life, 15 years, was 165 units, mechanical air conditioning units, that are proposed to be replaced as part of this solution. Most units have been replaced, so they have not been included over here, so we have 5 years, 10 years, 12 years. So our cutoff is 15 years and older, really.
And then to answer your question about how many units do you have that are less than 5 years, what we can provide as part of the next step when we're coming for consideration for one of the options, we can have what we'll have is a detailed mechanical inventory that would provide that type of information for units that we're not replacing. But the focus of what we have for information tonight is for the ones that are past their useful life.
Yeah, my question, the reason I ask is that we don't want to replace the unit which is working.
Oh, no. No, definitely not.
Or the new, or even so.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So all of the cutoff is for the units is anything that's over 15 years old, right, that is past its useful life, they're inefficient. And so this is going to upgrade it to today's standards for efficient technology, high efficiency HVAC, and reduce the energy consumption related to those units. All the ones that you have that you've been replacing the last 5 years, in general, those are all high efficiency units that the district has everywhere. Okay. And those will not be replaced in any portion of this.
Just out of curiosity, on page 4 where you showed the costs per square foot.
Oh, the baseline.
Got it.
I noticed number 4 is Nogales High School. Do they have a lot of those older units? Because I'm thinking that Nogales, with all the new construction and stuff, I thought the cost would be a lot lower, that it would have been built with energy efficient materials,
sure,
insulation, et cetera.
There's only 3 units at Nogales, and those are wall-mounted unit heat pumps. So those are typically on portables. Uh-huh. You can answer more.
I also believe that Nogales has additional square footage now from previously, before it was built. That NPR is quite large, mm-hmm, and we still have probably 14 additional classrooms. We have 14 more classrooms there now than before the project started.
But when you break it down, cost per square foot, that wouldn't make any difference, would it?
Well, we also have a very old pool that's running there, too, mm-hmm, from an energy perspective and a footprint. So, your point is valid.
Oftentimes, too, what you see, and I'm not sure if this is happening at Nogales, but oftentimes we see at newer schools, especially during construction, operating expenditures could be higher because you have different staff and teams that are working through, more extended hours on the sites as well.
And I'm sorry also, the what I wanted to share with the square footage, it's a different building square footage. Mm-hmm. They're very large buildings that take more energy to cool and to heat because they're quite rather large, like the NPR.
Yes.
On the same page, Why, if you had older units, would the price go up? Does that cause it, you know, the price to be higher because they're older units and not functioning correctly?
Yeah, older units oftentimes will consume, they do consume more energy because they're inefficient, but it's really a mixture of different things. It's how, what are the run hours? The lighting has a big component of that, and just the general operations of the school and insulation. I mean, there's so many different factors, so I wouldn't say that the higher dollar per square foot sites, it's solely based on having older units. It's generally a number of factors.
Because is Blandford our biggest elementary school with the most students? The vice principal told me that. And I just was curious why they would be the second lowest in cost if we have the most students at that elementary school.
Don't have air conditioners.
No, they have air conditioning. So there are a number of different factors that go into it. I mean, their classrooms are full, for one, in terms of when you look at the number of classrooms that are being used might be compared to other school sizes, but their classrooms are full. And it would be something where we'd need to do a deeper analysis to see. But it is one of our larger elementary schools. You are correct.
And so this is just a summary here. So, and if there's any sites that the board or staff would like further information on that's more detailed, we'd be certainly happy to provide that.
And I can add one more point out there. The building operation systems or the building control system, you could have newer units at a newer school, but again, the efficiency is only good up to a point. Really, it depends on how often do you run the system. Do you run the system when there's nobody in the room? Is the system on or left on during weekends when nobody's there? Is the set point too low? Teachers have full control of the set points, and some teachers will probably crank it low. Some teachers will probably crank it high. Depends on both. And this is, again, cooling and heating energy. And when I say heating, it's fan energy as well. So one of the energy conservation measures that's recommended is to upgrade the control system to further optimize the controls for it. So make sure we have, to give you an example, the new control system would actually have occupancy sensors or motion sensors that are used to control lighting. So basically you would actually, so if nobody's in a room, the motion sensor, typically a motion sensor that controls lighting, will turn the lighting off and you will be saving energy. However, the mechanical unit in that room is still going to be cooling the room. So what we do is we actually have a dual technology sensor that actually has a relay going from the occupancy sensor tied to the HVAC unit. So students leave for a field trip or even for lunch breaks, and the occupancy sensor does not see motion for 15 minutes. It will go from, say, it's cooling to 74 degrees. It will raise the set point so that the system doesn't run that hard, and it will raise it up to a certain level. If another half an hour passes by and still doesn't see any motion, it will basically turn it off, thereby you're saving energy. That's the benefit of the new control system, and you'll see that.
So are you talking about the air conditioning?
Yeah. And
so that means when the teacher leaves, for sure they can't leave the air conditioning on, and it would automatically be off during the evening.
Correct.
Hours.
And those parameters, it just depends. So if they're just going to lunch, it's not going to turn the unit off because it would have a hard time recovering.
Exactly.
But if it's an extended period of time and those parameters can be built with staff's input, then it'll turn off. And so that will help to probably, to see the benefit of having the newer, more efficient school.
I have a question about the pending construction that we're planning. Do you guess or make adjustments depending on what needs might change with the new construction?
Yes, and so during the development process, that was a number of the different conversations that took place about impact of different construction projects that are going to be going on and how that will impact the building usage per square foot and the potential savings. But that, you know, obviously the construction projects are going to be kind of evolving as time goes on. So it's a type of thing that we can continually model the impact of that and provide that to the staff for those type of decisions.
Any more questions?
So I'm going back to...
Go ahead. Still going, sorry.
Sure.
Yeah, I have a question on the scope of work.
Yes.
This chart here. And some of them are leave blank. That means not applicable, or is this no change?
It means that there's not a need for this type of scope there. And it doesn't mean that they don't have that type of system, but it just means that there's not a need. Is there a specific one that you were looking at?
I'm looking at the one at the second column, the PRC and the MOT. Those are blank.
For the integration of the occupancy sensors?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We can look into that, but oftentimes it could be that, one, that the infrastructure doesn't make sense to have that, or two, that it's not cost-effective for... The savings potential of putting that
there's
in
no,
there.
No change.
Yeah, it wouldn't make an impact. Yeah. Do you have anything
else? Yeah, I go ahead and add. And what Ashley mentioned is absolutely right. I'll just add a little to it. Our first priority is always a school, because then in school, when we integrate motion sensors to HVAC units, mm-hmm. we do it in classrooms first, because classrooms, if you look at it, classrooms forms like around 50% of your heating and air conditioning load and lighting load. Typically, your electrical load, half of it is classrooms. You attack half of the load, you basically get mm-hmm. a major reduction in there. And after that, it's basically diminishing returns based on the cost that you add to it. Also, it's based on the orientation of the room. A classroom mm-hmm. is much better than an open office space in an MOT where you might not sense everybody moving around. So that's why you start adding more sensors and you start controlling it more. It just doesn't mm-hmm. become cost prohibitive. So.
But to that point, like, for instance, with water conservation, for instance, which we haven't gotten to yet, but just you see that there's blanks there for the MOT and for Hollingworth, mm-hmm. and that is because there's not an irrigation system to control there. Mm-hmm. And at MOT, it doesn't apply. So each case is different, and we could certainly provide any further details as needed.
Okay. So what is the number on the high efficiency wall mounted heat pump? Is the number of pumps needs, or what's the number?
The number of units for that column is that the.
Is the number of units?
Those are the number of units.
Number of units you require.
Number of units that
you need. Okay.
So in places where you don't see any units, mm-hmm. again, it's a combination of couple of factors. Mm-hmm. One is. You might have already replaced them, mm-hmm. so they are newer. They don't really meet that criteria. Second is the energy savings. So depending on our site observations, whether a system's running as much, mm-hmm. whether the utility consumption at that site is pretty high or is it pretty low. If it's pretty low, then you really may be turning those units off, and then it doesn't really make sense to replace the unit because the energy savings isn't really there. So we look at several factors before selecting the type of unit. Again, then that's when we sit down with staff and have these interactions and say, like, hey, here's a particular school, and I'll just pick an example, Blandford Elementary School. The staff says the units are old, but then we come out and say, like, hey, we looked at it. Units are old, but you really don't have enough energy savings. But here's another campus at Telesis where the units may not be that old, or they probably are right around 15 years. Mm-hmm. And they could be replaced as well, and the energy savings supports it. So what sometimes we do is we go back and forth, and we try to come up with a collaborative solution where we say, okay, let's try to find out some more lighting, some more low-hanging fruits, more energy savings, so as to really take care of the units at Blandford. Even though the energy savings might be less, it's still a headache item for facilities to deal with this. And that's how we start collaborating, and that's why we have so many meetings. But you mm-hmm. might see some things blank, but that's for a reason there. Okay. So.
I might be jumping ahead here, but on the same chart, the first two columns is your building automation system, BAS. Mm-hmm. And in order to get to the Cisco Energy Manager, which is at the very end, you have to go to option 3.
Yes.
But they're both included. Is the Cisco Energy Manager different than the BAS?
It is. The Cisco Energy Manager is strictly related to the IT infrastructure, and that is all of the IT components that are on the system server, the servers, the switches, the routers, computers. That's specific to the IT infrastructure. Building automation system is specific to more of the mechanical systems and how that ties into the lighting as well. So they're two different.
Okay, but then the interior LED lighting upgrades,
mm-hmm.
a lot of those are in option three also.
So each option is really based on the number of funding, the amount of funding and various levels of funding. So the way that they were built was purely just based on various levels of funding and input from staff on what made the most sense.
Okay.
One line over there, and you're absolutely right. Some of the interior lighting is not included in either the option one or the option
right.
two. And again, brings back to the fact when we sit down with staff, the biggest hot button pressure point that the staff is facing right now is the cooling towers, the existing cooling towers. You have six central plants have cooling towers that are over 20 years old that are failing. Your beta element already has a failed cooling tower. So with the limited money that we would have, the biggest item that we wanted to take care of and still have enough savings so that the each option stands on its own was to include cooling towers. So each of the new cooling tower actually is a stainless steel unit body. All of the new six cooling towers, they have variable frequency drives to control the fan so as to minimize the energy consumption. That's the main point. So we actually included cooling towers, heavy mechanical in each option, and then included as much lighting as we could, as much savings we need to actually make the project stand on its own, each option stand on its own. That's why you see different options or different boxes checked as the options grow bigger.
As you can recall, during spring break, we had your beta that the cooling tower had really reached its life expectancy and needed some major repairs. So we directed Climatech to really look at as one of the focus points if the first dollars that we could spend on something that we would need to replace immediately within the next few years so our students would have a comfortable classroom to be in, and that the cooling towers would help for mm-hmm. six of our schools, I believe.
Yes, six. Yep.
How did the staff decide some schools get it and some schools don't?
Well, if I can just, because mm-hmm. it was staff, it was those particular six schools that have that same cooling system. They have the cooling towers. So those would be the ones that are at that age that they were replaced around the same time. They're going to be mm-hmm. failing in the very near future. So that's the reason why, because these would be of need most. We also it was a team effort. We had the maintenance department and Chris Faro, who provided Marcos, who provided valuable input regarding what were the needs for our schools. And this was one of the areas that we needed. It wasn't particularly a school, but it was a system that we needed to replace.
And on the cooling towers, not every site has that type of mechanical system. It's the central plants. It's limited to a select number of sites.
Well, even the lighting, how do you decide? Again, you decided mm-hmm. how the worst ones are going to go be fixed on phase one. And then phase two later for some other ones?
With phase one, option one is purely based on Prop 39. And so Prop 39 is the grant dollars. And there's very stringent requirements that have to be met to qualify for that pot of money. And it is all based on what they called a savings to investment ratio, or it's just a fancy way of saying ROI or payback. And it has to meet certain requirements. So it is a engineering effort to be able to look at first, what are you spending currently? And then the art comes into what are the needs of the sites, like the cooling towers? And then how can we get that to qualify for the one? It's a 1.01 requirement. That's the SIR requirement. So for every dollar you spend, you have to achieve $1 and a penny of savings. So it's a combination of a number of different factors to make sure that that qualifies. And so those are the sites that offer the energy savings potential or have the needs or have the infrastructure for that particular type of fixture that pays back in the requirements of the Prop 39 funding.
And is there a limit on Prop 30?
There is a limit. Yeah. So it's if it,
all of our schools. Yeah. Needed, when we prove that we needed.
Yes, it is limited. And in a couple of slides, we'll get into the actual funding sources and how that all works.
Okay.
One quick thing.
This, sure.
And I'm totally out of my league on this.
No problem.
But when I was working for the Department of Health, we put in cogeneration plants in our facilities where we use steam from our kitchen to run a turbine, which generated electricity that we sold back to Edison, then ran the steam through a chilling tower and used that to air condition the facility basically free. Is that beyond something like this that we could do here at our facilities, a cogeneration plant?
No, it's not. I mean, cogeneration is still could still be a viable option. Again, it really depends on, like you said, the kitchen. Actually, there was a cogeneration is always like if you have a need for the waste heat. If your pools are heated, then a perfect example is to put a cogeneration system to heat a pool. But then you have a myriad of factors to look at. A cogeneration system is expensive. So if you're just looking at using Prop 39, then Prop 39 has certain guidelines to meet, and then cogeneration may not really fall into it. Sometimes even photovoltaics is tough to meet under that Prop 39 guidelines. But can it be done? Yes, it can be. As long as you have a good space for the waste heat to be used, because all it's all about waste heat. If you can use the waste heat efficiently at all times, at enough time so that you can base load the cogeneration system, it's great. And, but then also it depends on do you have space for it, how often can you run it, what's the maintenance going to look on it, are you going to own the system or is it going to be somebody else who does like a power purchase agreement and somebody else operates it and you guys just pay for the gas. How's gas prices? Because most all of these systems will be gas fired. So how does what gas prices are? Where's utility electric prices? You could probably have fluctuations. Are you going to hedge the gas? Are you going to buy most of the gas up front? All of those factors really really play a role in trying to put a cogeneration system. The system that you mentioned was probably a gas fired, maybe a micro turbine or an engine. Goes to the steam turbine, and then you actually have an absorption chiller sitting on top of that, right? That's I used to do cogeneration before, so it's a pretty it's a topic very close to my heart. But again, it has to be the right application.
Yeah, we would get free air conditioning from the chiller towers.
Yeah,
it was great.
You use heat to cool.
Yeah,
I doubt that we generate enough steam in our little kitchen.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to move on to the last category, which is the other upgrades. And so, as we mentioned, this is really about looking at what are ways to upgrade your infrastructure and help contain operating expenditures. So outside of just purely energy, there's water to think about. And although Proposition 39 funding does not qualify for water conservation through the other two options, option 2 and 3, that is something that makes sense to look at for the district. And so currently what the district has for its irrigation are local irrigation controllers at each site. So anytime there's a leak or a flood, or if it's raining on a particular day or there's inclement weather, staff generally has to go out site to site to maintain that system. And like we said before, when you're trying to do more with less resources, it can lead to substantial staff inefficiencies to have to go site to site, not to mention if there's a flood or if it's raining on the weekend. Oftentimes it creates substantial waste for water. So what this would do would this solution would upgrade the district's irrigation control system to a smart weather-based system. So if it's raining that day, the system automatically will not water. And most importantly, staff will be able to control the system from a remote central location, which will help them to just be more efficient in maintaining the fields and in any of the irrigation systems.
Did you find that we had a lot of waste of water when you did your findings at the school sites?
This measure is definitely pays for itself and will offer additional savings on top of that. So there is enough savings potential to pay for this measure and upgrade the technology. Another component, like we said, is IT infrastructure, which is it's different than looking at the energy management systems that control the energy infrastructure. IT is a little different. And the district has Cisco and Cisco IT products and infrastructure throughout the district. And our company works very closely with Cisco on a number of projects to help address ways to generate savings or to reduce, wasted operating costs related to these type of systems. So with the Energy Manager for Cisco, what it is essentially a software that will help the district to, instead of powering and running and maintaining all of the IT systems, computers, servers, switches, routers, at full power, even when it's not necessary, what the Energy Manager does, it helps to run certain systems in the parameters that staff sets at a lower power mode at times where it's just simply not needed to be at full power. So that's going to generate continual savings and also be a benefit for the IT staff. In addition to that, one of the needs that the district and staff let us know about was the old legacy phone system that the district has throughout all the sites. And there's a substantial maintenance consideration and cost related to operating this old legacy system because it's antiquated and parts simply can't be ordered for this old phone system anymore. So, and not to mention, it's hard, you can't get a service contract generally on these type of systems. It's hard to service, maintain, creates inefficiencies in staff time. I know in January, I'm not sure what site it was, Alex, but I know one of the phone system went down at one of the sites, and the IT staff had to go on eBay and order parts for this whole phone system. So what this would do is just bring all of the communication the communication platform for voice over IP up to today's standards and help to integrate into systems like bells and alarms and safety systems, police, fire, integrate all of the district's communication into one seamless type of system. Instead, the current system that you have is just voice. So the upgrading to today's standards in that type of technology would give you voice and video and just help essentially each site to operate more efficiently from a communication standpoint. And ultimately, too, it would be much less expensive for the district to maintain, and the concerns about being able to order parts and maintain the system wouldn't be a concern any longer. In the next slide, if there's no more questions on the particular scope of work, I was going to review the financial highlights for each of the different options. So the first one is option one, and just as to remember, all the scope items that you see in blue. And so we've summarized the scope again at the top in a bullet format, just as a reminder. So essentially this is HVAC upgrades at four sites, the central plant upgrades, interior lighting at five sites, exterior lighting at seven sites, and then building automation upgrades district-wide. So this is the scope of work that qualifies for the Proposition 39 grant funding. So this option one would be 100% funded by this grant. And there is urgency for the district to move on this, and that's because the deadline to apply for this funding is August 1st of this summer. So based on the deadline, we would get this scope, regardless of which option the district decided to move forward with. We would make sure that this application is turned in on time, and Sandeep's team has tremendous experience in navigating that process through the state. So the $3.6 million that you see, that's a turnkey not to exceed maximum price. So in all options that you see, it's a guaranteed maximum price. There's absolutely no change orders unless the district were to request one from us. If there's any savings that are realized, if any of the budgets come in lower, those savings will be passed on to the district. If there's any unaccounted for existing conditions or improperly budgeted scope of work item, then that is on Climatech. This is a not to exceed maximum price in so it's from start to finish. That's the price, just to be clear. So life cycle savings, those are the savings that are generated over the life of the new equipment. So this is 15 years for these scope items. And again, this is 100% funded by Proposition 39. And the net impact, meaning what, how does that truly impact the district's bottom line, would be about $5.5 million in operating budget savings over the life of the equipment.
The main question I have, though, is it talks about high-efficiency HVAC upgrades at four sites.
Yep.
But on your chart here, you have sites other than school sites. You have, like, the RIC. PRC, I'm not too sure what that is, MOT. How do I know if those four sites are school sites or ancillary support sites?
We could signify that and change the bullet to show that. This shows which the names of the sites are, and this is just summarizing it at the top. Yeah. And in our agreement for that we would bring forward, it would have very clearly, it would say
because
what the sites were.
My preference is that we put the monies where the students are. So if I'm going to upgrade four sites, I would want those to be four school sites that affect mm-hmm. children directly. Whereas the RIC, you know, it's not that I don't want the teachers to have air conditioning. It's just that I prefer the school sites to have it first.
So the way the four sites were selected, if you look at the four sites and to the...
They're all school sites. They're all school sites.
They're all schools?
In the blue.
Yeah, it's Hurley, Northam, Santana, and Villa Corta.
In the blue.
Yeah, I'm looking at the blue.
I know they're all very close to it. It's compact.
Yeah, it's hard to tell tell the blue and the green.
I think it's also important just to note for the board that we are not asking for action or decision from the board. This is simply an information item. So we are not asking, and it's not agendized in terms of sharing a preference. It is absolutely intended for you to ask clarifying questions, just as exactly the way that the board is doing tonight. But we're not asking for action, nor are we asking for direction. This is just information for the board this evening, because we know that these are some big things that you're going to have to be able to mull over, and it will be coming forward to the board at a future meeting regarding a request for action.
It just would, if you could do these summary sheet with these options and
sure.
sites, it would be helpful rather than having to go back to the chart.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so the second option, that's everything in blue and green. Those are HVAC upgrades at seven sites, the same central plant upgrades at six sites, interior lighting at seven sites, exterior lighting district-wide, and then the building automation scopes is the same. And what's added now is the weather-based irrigation control system. So again, this is a not to exceed guaranteed maximum price of $6.2 million. The life cycle savings generated over the life of this scope of work is $12.4 million. And the funding sources are, again, the Proposition 39 grant, and then the balance would be district funds at $2.6 million. The net savings, the net impact to the general fund in this option is $8.8 million.
I have a question just as we look at these different funding options. So the Prop 39 is a grant, no impact to our district general fund.
Correct.
These are grant funds. So when we look at option one and we say that the net general fund saving is $5 million, it could also be read that the general fund saving over the life of the product really is $9 million because that grant were not our dollars.
Well, there's two different things. So life cycle savings are the gross savings that are generated over
yes.
the life of the equipment.
Right.
And that's utility and operational savings that are based on the mandated assumptions that the CEC provides. Then there's also what's in life cycle savings per industry standards is a capital savings that's generated by using those funds for things you're going to have to do anyway. And so it's not – you can't quantify a net impact to the general fund based on an avoided cost. So that's just the true operating expenditures dropping to the bottom line because there's no payment or anything associated going out.
How do you get the net general fund savings, $8,833,000?
What was the question?
How do you get a number of net general fund savings for $8 million?
So that's based on the 15-year energy and operational expenditures, and water savings as well. And the assumptions that are used in that model that we put together are mandated by the California Energy Commission, and we use the same assumptions that we used for the Proposition 39. Option as we do for all of the options for consistency. So it's based on the assumptions that are provided for that. And do you want to talk about the percentages?
Yeah. So as Ashley mentioned, it's basically the life cycle, the savings is made up of three different components. Your utility savings, you're just based on your energy expenditure to the utility, the operational savings, and then the capital cost that you would be that you'll have to put anyways for these future projects. So the breakdown is for this option, if I remember it right, it's around 49% in energy, just strictly energy savings, 22% in operational savings, and the remainder is your capital cost, which is right around 29%.
And those percentages that he's mentioning apply to the life cycle savings. That's the gross number that you see, the 12.4. The true net general fund savings are just based off of operating expenditures that the district will realize in its existing budgets, because the new equipment and the new scope of work is going to use less energy and require less maintenance.
Over what time period?
15 years.
Okay.
So you mean the total lifetime life cycle saving $12 million is not in part of that $8 million. So $8 million is on top of this life
saving? No. Uh-huh. It's the net. So the life cycle savings number also includes avoided capital expenditures related to the deferred maintenance needs that have to be funded in the next several years. And so the Proposition 39 grant dollars provides a capital savings associated, because you're using grant dollars instead of having to use general fund or maintenance budgets or bond funding to address that work. So the life cycle savings also quantifies that capital savings. The net savings truly just quantifies the savings in your existing budgets. So those are the true general fund savings.
Yeah, I just tried to make the simple math of these numbers, but it won't work out.
The simple math would be your total life cycle savings of $12.49 million
right.
Minus your the 2.6. Sorry, 12.4 minus the 3.6.
The district funds, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
That
I see.
You,
8.8. Oh, I see. Okay, that. So the saving, including the Proposition 39 grant.
But if we have two HVAC employees mm-hmm. on staff, whether they have to maintain the new equipment or not, we're going to still have those same employees on payroll.
You're right. So, and those are those type of savings that are difficult to quantify. So what we have quantified in here is the maintenance assumption of 3% of the project amount per year is what the CEC, the Energy Commission, mandates. So those are those are quantified generally as when you don't have to hire an HVAC mechanical contractor to go and replace the unit, or you're not having to purchase new bulbs or rent a scissor lift to go out and replace the fixtures. The staff time is not generally quantifiable.
So that's true. All the operational things only includes savings that would be realized from getting extended warranties on this new equipment. You'll have 5-year compressor warranty on all your mechanical. You'll have 10-year warranties on your new LED lighting. So only the material savings, the equipment savings that you would get, is quantified in the operational savings. There is no labor savings associated in this at all. So just to be clear, it's your tangible savings.
And Dr. Mitchell, I don't know if you were trying to do the math, but there are some things that are not quantified generally as capital cost savings. There's just certain Yeah. There's certain measures that just they don't qualify as that, so they're not put in there. So it's not a direct add and subtract of that number. But we could certainly give a breakdown of any of these numbers in any way that you'd like to see them. Option three, so this is all of the colors that are listed and shown on the chart. So this is HVAC upgrades at 17 sites, the central plan upgrades at the 6 sites, interior and exterior lighting upgrade, LED lighting upgrades district-wide, the same building automation upgrades that we've talked about previously, the weather-based irrigation control system, and then the Cisco Energy Manager and the VoiceOver IP as well. So the total infrastructure improvements in this option are $12.1 million. Again, that's a not-to-exceed price. The life cycle savings generated over this equipment is this equipment's life cycle is $17.6 million. And the Proposition 39 grant funding is the same. And the district fund contribution in this option is $8.5 million. So the net impact, these are calculated using the same assumptions, is the $14.1 million that you see at the bottom.
On option three, is there something about solar also?
There's not. What we're going to show once we get through the next couple of slides is looking at this as a two-prong approach. So this right now we understand because the board is going on hiatus in July. The next board meeting, the board will consider to consider one of these three options for an energy efficiency program. And then in the fall, what we can do is come back and be able to present when there's more time to consider and really understand the technology and the different options that are available, looking at solar or renewable solution as a second phase to this. And many districts that we work with approach it that way. First look at reducing your consumption and then looking at ways to take it further through generation. So
if I can add, sure. We knew that solar is an interest of the board and also of the district for potential cost savings. So we did ask that we explore the option of solar, but we also know that this is a process and it would take time to also inform all of our stakeholders, inform the community, let them all know about solar and the benefits of it, and it can't be a quick decision, and it will take some time and a process for it.
And on option three, do we have enough money for the district to come up with $8.5 million?
We'll have to look very closely. More discussion will be needed.
Pardon me?
There'd be more discussion. We would have to take a look at all of the different options that we have.
The questions.
Yes.
For total life cycle savings,
yes.
That number, that's a very important number because we see how much you want to save. Mm-hmm. How accurate is that? For 15 years, you have to consider the factor of the energy cost increase while you keep inflating. So how accurate is that? That's how very difficult for us to predict. 15 years.
That is true.
How the energy price is going to be.
I mean, so we actually, the energy department at Climatech actually has a crystal ball that we look for. And we actually see, 15 years, 10 years. I'm just kidding. It is all based on assumptions that are validated through studies by utilities, by third-party engineers, by consultants. Overall industry standard. So you're right there. The 17.6 million or any life cycle savings number actually has an escalation rate built into each year because utility prices are going up. And again, utilities have their own way of raising prices. There are years that they will raise the price that it will probably be flat. And there are years that it will shoot up like 8%, like San Diego Gas and Electric. You guys have Southern California Edison. San Diego Gas and Electric raised a price like 8% in 1 year. 8%. And then they probably stay stable. Sometimes they raise 2% each year. So it's like all over the map. So we have looked at historical, as part of our projects process, we actually have something called as performance assurance. So we actually look at rate increases over year after year for different utilities. California Energy Commission, CEC, that actually administers the Prop 39 program has guidelines on what could be used as escalation rates, utility escalation rates, because that's something that's been calculated in their formulas. So the escalation rate used in this formula is 4% each year. Now, that's an average escalation rate for up to 15 years.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to see two numbers on this category, one conservative and one aggressive. So minimum, how much you're going to save, you estimate?
Well, so that's an average, and you could pick a number, really. Just because they would go all over. So 4% is what has been accepted industrially as well as what's been recommended by California Energy Commission. So we are doing this as part of Prop 39. We kind of stick to those guidelines. Historically, we have seen anywhere from 3% to as high as 8% in a year. But then utilities sometimes change them every 3 years, then sometimes every 2 years. It really depends on market conditions and how utilities really project that. So right now, it's 4%, but that's really, we have a guideline for it, and it's really mandated by California Energy Commission.
But the reality is, in 15 years, whatever we put in today, in 15 years, it's going to be a dinosaur. So,
yeah, the new stuff doesn't sound like it lasts any longer than the old stuff. 15 years is what you're talking about.
Right. Well, true. That's true. And that's, again, mandated by certain organizations. Like the useful life of each equipment, say it's mechanical, air conditioning, or lighting, or cooling towers, mm-hmm. is all based on industry professionals and academic professionals who actually form organizations like the ASHRAE organization, the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, Air Conditioning Engineers. It's a mouthful, really. Those people actually say this kind of equipment will last at least 15 years. To give you an example, LEDs, new LEDs, like the old technology, which is the fluorescent tubes, they lasted around 10 to 15 years, some of them probably 17 years. So the average came to 15. LEDs, and when they go out. It's like gone. I mean, it's dark. LEDs are rated differently. So LEDs, actually, the way they say is based on its rated life. It's like at the end of its useful life or at the end of 15 years, LEDs would operate at 70% or 60% of their rated output when they were first designed, of year one output. So they still would run, they would still operate, it's just that they would operate at a lower light level. So we kind of have a boundary to calculate life cycle savings and everything for 15 years because that's what's mandated. But in reality, these things could last more than 15 years. They could even last somewhat less than 15 years. And again, it's an average.
And like the central plant solution, it's going to be much better technology than the district currently have. That's not going to be as susceptible to corrosion because it's stainless steel. The LED technology, it's going to be a big improvement over what the district currently has. Those last much longer. So it really just depends on the actual equipment itself. But in general, we have to use an average life cycle, and so 15 years is what's accepted as the norm. And just real quick on the savings estimates, obviously it would be great to see an aggressive projection of what's possible, but it's always in our best interest and the district's best interest to be conservative in the assumptions. And so Sandeep's team, all of these projects, they provide a performance assurance or a guarantee on the savings. So generally, our assumptions are conservative. Just to give you an idea, we have a track record for all of our energy savings guarantees and performance guarantees that we have throughout the entire Southwest. And I looked at the end of Q1 March, in Sandeep's team, they're performing at 124% of their projection. So they're achieving 124% of their guaranteed savings. 121. So generally they are conservative, but it has to be that way.
But when you look at life cycles for these types of things, mm-hmm. it's no different than when we go out and purchase things on our own and they tell us the AC unit we buy for our house has a life cycle mm-hmm. of, 10 years, or a roof has one of 20 years.
It could.
It's just the best estimate.
And how those are operated obviously greatly impacts the unit. So the district, having a building automation system that makes sure units are off when no one's in the room is going to provide less wear and tear on the unit. So there's a number of factors that can contribute to that. Climate conditions,
15 years is across the entire nation. Right. California has 16 climate
zones. Yeah. Can I interrupt your presentation for just a second?
Sure.
I need to talk to the board about how we're going to proceed. Do you want to cover solar tonight? We've still got solar. We have the Mandarin program, and we have closed session. We could put the Mandarin off until June, if that's your preference.
And solar until the fall.
And solar until the fall. So we're not going to do solar, right? You know, so we need to make a decision. I don't want to sit here till 11 o'clock tonight covering everything.
I concur with the president.
Which one? Which part of it? Okay, so you want to put the Mandarin off? And what about solar? Shall we put that off also?
For the Prop 39, where we have to, you said August was
August
the deadline.
August 1st.
Solar will not be a part of Prop 39.
Solar is
separate
out.
And apart. And it would be, we would not be bringing any of that back forward for further discussion to the board until sometime well into the fall after the start of the school year.
That's a mute issue.
Solar presenter, the same group.
Yeah, we're the same people, but we're happy to come back. We're just down the street, so.
If we put the Mandarin program off, does that interfere with the implementation of the program at all, the timeliness?
We can postpone it till our June meeting, but know that next Tuesday is also a full meeting, and the 13th is a full meeting. So we have a lot of fun ahead of us. Okay. The Mandarin part can be done very, very briefly. It's no action on that item either. It really is whatever's the pleasure of the board.
Okay. Can I ask how long do you think the solar
presentation? We could go through it pretty quick. The point is just to introduce you to the technology and some of the considerations that the board can start thinking about for fall.
What is pretty quick? 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Sure, we could do it in 2 minutes. I mean, we could do it as quick as you want. We could just go through real quick and explain it.
It's really up
to you, whatever.
No questions.
Sure.
The questions are what are slowing them down.
Any questions?
I'd rather cover it properly and put it forward and not do it tonight, because there's no sense in us just getting a quick report and not really understand what you're talking about.
Sure.
And then do you want to do the Mandarin then tonight if it's going to be very short?
I was doing Mandarin tonight and put the solar next time.
Sounds good.
Right. Okay. Shall we go across Donna? Is that fine for you, David?
How long would the Mandarin take?
5 minutes.
Oh,
5 minutes.
Do it now.
No, we're not going to do it all.
Oh,
that's for your reading.
Okay.
Mrs. Pride?
Okay.
Sorry if we took up too much of your time.
It's not your fault. We asked a lot of questions. And I'd rather do that now than be sorry later.
Sure. So we'll conclude with this. Okay, next steps. So tonight's the study session on this was updated. It's actually June 13th now. We're going to be coming back for consideration of one of these three options that were presented tonight. The construction and mobilization for that scope of work is anticipated to begin over summer. There's a lot of work that can be installed when rooms are unoccupied. But the duration of that is going to, depending on which option is chosen, could take anywhere from 12 to 18 months. And board consideration for the solar would happen in fall and winter at staff and board's direction on when you'd like to receive that information.
So when do we have to vote on this, on which option?
June 13th.
Okay, so prior to June 13th, could we have the options detailed out as to the site?
Certainly. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. We'll send them to your office, Mr. Flores.
Just a quick question.
Sure.
So you apply for the grant on August 1st. That's the deadline.
Before, yes. Mm-hmm.
Then once the state says, yes, you get the grant,
mm-hmm.
do we have a time limit to spend it?
Yes. And so by June of 18, you actually have to encumber the funds. And what that means is that you've issued purchase orders and that you've moved along with committing to spend the funds. And then construction has to be done by 2020.
Okay.
So there'll be no concerns with meeting those those deadlines.
And it's a turnkey service, so they'll act as our construction managers throughout the whole process.
Mm-hmm. And all the compliance. So it's one thing to note is that there's an annual report that's required for between now and 2024 for the Energy Commission. Annual reports, progress reports, and Climatech will take care of all of that on the district's behalf.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Then we'll move on to 2C, which is the dual language immersion Mandarin program update.
Good evening.
The quick facts, right?
I'm going to try to be really quick, well, but it's really just an update. I've included a lot of slides, but it's basically a lot of research that we've done and I've shared with our committee. So those are things that you could look on your own if you would like. So we're going to get started with, in the fall, we met as a dual immersion committee. Dr. Mitchell said that was something that we wanted to pursue and look at and establish a committee to look at research, visit sites, learn more about what were the logistics, what were the pros and the cons of having a Mandarin dual immersion program in the district. And what follows is just really some of the research that I just mentioned to you that I shared with the committee. Then we go into, let's see.
Do you have another one of the PowerPoint presentations?
To what? Yes. Do you want another?
Yeah, I don't have one.
Can you pass that to David?
So we go into some of the recommendations. If you look at this slide, there's certain things that we obviously need to have a Mandarin dual immersion program. So one of the recommendations, of course, or the most critical thing is staffing. That's actually one of the issues that we may have because statewide there is not many teachers that are BCLAT certified in Chinese. So that's something that Ms. Healy and I have been doing. We've been going to conferences and trying to recruit teachers to come, but they have to, of course, be qualified, have a multiple subject credential, and have a BCLAT. For us to start the program, our recommendation is that we would have to hire at least two BCLAT teachers to begin the program, possibly in the primary levels. The other real important thing is, of course, our Common Core aligned materials. As you know, in our Spanish dual immersion program, all the adopted materials are available in Spanish and English. But when it comes to the Chinese language, there are no state adopted materials. So we did find English language arts materials, which is called the Better Immersion Materials, and they're Common Core aligned. Again, just to remind you, it's not necessarily state adopted, but it's what most of our Mandarin schools in the state use, and it is Common Core aligned, and it has a lot of nonfiction and fiction that goes with science and social studies. We also found that there was, in our research, there's a lot of literature, of course, for books, for kids, for nonfiction and fiction that we would need to purchase based on our new Common Core standards. And in terms of teaching, we would need, obviously, social studies and science. And those materials at this time are not readily available. What we would do is have team teachers plan some Common Core concepts in those areas. So, for instance, what were the main concepts in social studies that we might want to use in Mandarin or teach in Mandarin? Or what are some of the main concepts in science? Because that's not readily available. The other critical component is the percentage of students that we have in the class. Ideally, we would want to have 50% English speakers and 50% native speakers of the target language, which would be Mandarin. That's not always the case. We could also go to one-third, 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 which is what most of the districts have, which means that we have one-third English speakers, one-third native speakers, and one-third bilingual speakers. But ideally, for us to start a program, we would want to try to go to the 50-50. Another thing we found is that we needed to make sure that we had enough time in advance to plan for the program. A year was recommended at least to begin to prepare the curriculum, work with teachers, plan the units, and so forth. There are some state guiding principles that we need to have in effect or actually promote or develop even more in terms of having a successful Mandarin program. And some of those are what's listed there, which is the administrative support, you know, professional development, and ongoing evaluation. I'm skipping some of them, but basically for our model, there's the 90-10 model usually for languages that use a similar alphabetic system, and there's also a 50-50 model, and those are used for languages that have a different system. So we are recommending as a committee for now the 50-50 model. And this is usually what it looks like in terms of going through the grade level, with the Mandarin being 50-50 from kinder through sixth grade. These are some of the commitment considerations for students and parents and also for us as a district. And our committee, this is our next steps that we have for 17-18 school year. We want to continue to recruit teachers because we're, you know, pretty much speaking to teachers when we go to conferences. We're trying to make sure that we sell our district, and we want to make sure we actually sell California to some, because we did go to the Houston conference where we met a lot of teachers that we're trying to recruit. We also want to distribute a parent survey to see the interest, because there's a lot of different areas in the Mandarin Dual Immersion Program that we want parent input in. We also want to continue with our committee. We have a great committee of district staff, teachers, principals, parents, and community members. And they want to continue to do some research, go to some more visits, and maybe have some community meetings. And lastly, before we begin our program, we want to make sure we have a way of evaluating the program. So we want to develop outcomes and benchmarks in terms of the Mandarin dual language program and an evaluation process to see how successful it is and also how we improve it on an annual basis. So that's in a nutshell. I know it's really quick, but.
Nice job, Sylvia. Any questions?
I agree with you. We need to a strong administrative support, and I think we need someone had experience in dual immersion Chinese, as Chinese speaking administrator, so the administrator can coach, can evaluate, and can guide the teachers,
mm-hmm.
and otherwise the teachers can do whatever they own, but the administrator doesn't know what's going on. And also, we need to have the information to the community as soon as possible. And usually, the other district, they offer once a month for an information meeting to the community, so to attract and recruit the students to the program. Usually start from next September, then every month they have a short meeting and to the community, so then we can attract more kids, and also we can attract kids from other district or the stop the kids losing kids to other district because of the program.
We definitely want to do that. At this point, we're in our research phase, so before we try to explain to parents where our program is. We want to make sure we develop it. Mm-hmm. But in, we have talked in the committee, I didn't mention that in my slides, about parental involvement and the importance of it, and that is another critical area for the success of the program. But right now, as a committee, we just want to get input in from parents in terms of their interests, in terms of the program, and so that we could develop it. And as soon as we have it refined, then we go and do your what you mentioned in terms of having those monthly meetings and trying to promote it. Mm-hmm. But at least at that point, we would have what the program is about, what is our model, who's our staff, our curriculum, and also more importantly, our benchmarks and outcomes for that program.
And another suggestions, since we're going to do 50-50, so this means we're going to have two classrooms with one Chinese teacher teaching Chinese and the other one teaching English, and a switch.
Yeah, that's a committee recommendation at mm-hmm. this point. All this is just recommendations that I'm reporting from the committee. Nothing has been
And also for aligning with Common Core, I think that's very kind of difficult because the language is a completely different concept. Chinese is a pictorial language, is the different as a word, and also Chinese language is quite difficult to the English speakers. So, and very 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 difficult for the Chinese language along with the Common Core concept. Especially picking reading books. So we have to have the very experienced teacher or the administrator to pick the reading books for the reading as material to align with the Common Core like this. So we need an experienced Chinese speaking administrator or the to assist to help the teachers to achieve that.
One of the things that we see as a pitfall of a Mandarin dual program mm-hmm. is sometimes that the parents don't stay in the program because of the rigor of it. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason we want to pursue as much as possible mm-hmm. that it's Common Core and it's as rigorous as English, so that when the students leave in sixth grade, they're biliterate and bilingual. But yes, it's not going to be exactly the same because Chinese is a totally different language. But our goal is to have that rigorous program that's Common Core aligned in both languages.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there a timeline for the parent survey and to start collecting data?
For the parent survey? Oh, you want to go ahead? I know we did our LCAP survey right now and a few months ago, so our parent survey, what I hope to go out is this summer and continue in the fall. I have a lot of parents that come to summer school, so my goal is to talk to principals that are there and kind of talk to parents just on an individual basis as opposed to the survey that we'll send out. But I think a lot of the times when we talk to parents individually, too, it gives us a little bit more of an idea of what they're leaning toward, especially when it comes, sometimes things are lost in translations, but we will send out a paper survey for parents and an online survey, but also talking to them individually.
Thank you. Board, if you have other questions, you could send those to Dr. Mitchell to forward on to Ms. Rivas.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Okay, now we're on to written requests to address the board. Note that comments from the public will be heard on open topics as well as closed session agenda items. And remarks are limited again to 3 minutes unless extended further or limited by a vote of the board. A maximum of 20 minutes unless extended by the board is allotted for each subject discussed. Ordinarily, board members will not respond to presentations and no action can be taken. However, the board can give direction to staff following a presentation. We have one, Mr. Humphreys.
I'll make it fast so y'all get out of here. I'm about to lose my voice, which I know would be a heartbreaking experience.
Okay, folks, I'll make it fast. Number one, the Bond Oversight Committee member selection process, as noted by feedback from the district, is once a considerable amount of applications are received, they are reviewed, and a selection process begins. There are those who feel that this defines willful obstruction. At the Oswald Parent Public meeting up there with Mr. Flores noted, and thank you very much, that public trust has been lost. As a crying woman, and you had to say this was a beautiful thing here, a crying woman was expressing that there are many angry people at that meeting because they were told that they were going to get a two-story building with no toilet, and they got a one-story building with no toilet without consultation. Obviously, this goes to decades of the prominent district attitude that, as per a prominent district person, is simply a none of their blank business. What these angry people should have done instead of crying about it is organized to see that those board members who have betrayed them do not see a new term. To the issue of the classroom two doors, it's a no-brainer. You program for the catastrophic event. And as to the Nogales multipurpose construction design nightmare and albatross, will plague this district forever. And the failure of this district to integrate a comprehensive video surveillance security system at all locations, and especially the new ones, is just being out of contact with the 21st century. Also, notice the website changes for this Bond Oversight Committee is two step forwards and one step back, but there we have some progress. And as to Mr. Malcolm's situation about the progress with the vehicles and the pickup and so forth, at any school, it's got to be mandatory busing or a park and ride type situation. As to the comment of Mr. Malcolm about what about the staffing, all these systems are designed to decrease staff, to capital down. And also, in all this discussion you had about this power stuff tonight and saving so forth, nobody, and I mentioned it to them back there, you have to have an integrated power backup system because all this stuff, Edison goes, everything goes. And remember, the only way we can move forward is if we are honest about our past. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. It's time to recess to closed session. It is 8:16 p.m. Okay, the board is resuming open session at 9:57 p.m. During closed session, the Board of Education took the following action. Board of Education approved the promotion of Amy Grigsby to the position of elementary principal, effective July 1st, 2017, on a motion by Donna Friedman and a second by Angelina Pride. The vote of the board was as follows. Angelina Pride, yes. Lynn Ebenkamp, yes. Carrie Chen, yes. Donna Friedman, yes. And David Malcolm, yes. Next is number 6A, notice of upcoming public hearing. The Board of Education will hold a public hearing in the accordance with California Government Code number 4217-10 through 4217.18 at the regularly scheduled board meeting of June 13, 2017 to receive comments on the proposed energy conservation services with Climatech LLC. Public hearing will be held at 8. I'm going to leave that out. Sorry. The public hearing will be held on June 13th, 2017 at 7 p.m. at the district office in Roland Heights. The proposed energy conservation services with Climatech LLC will be available for public viewing should members of the public wish to view. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
I'll move. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting adjourned at 9:59.